And once again, it's time for another edition of Rockin' the Boat here on Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM, streaming live at www.freakradio.org or wherever else you're tuned into this broadcast. My name's the V-Man. Tonight on Rockin' the Boat, we'll hear a talk by Brian Avery. On April 5th, 2003, Brian Avery had most of his face shot off by an Israeli military soldier while attempting to rescue a young child in the line of fire. He spoke in Santa Cruz on March 14th at the Resource Center for Nonviolence. Tonight on Rockin' the Boat, we'll hear his presentation. Stand by, stay tuned for Brian Avery coming up next. Brian Avery was in the occupied territories beginning in January 2003, working as a volunteer with the International Solidarity Movement. On April 5th, 2003, he was shot in the face by the Israeli military while wearing a bright red jacket. When he raised himself from the ground, witnesses saw that his left cheek had almost been totally shot off. The bullet that struck Brian entered through the upper right side of his nose and blew out the bones of the left side of his nose, cheek, and upper jaw. A doctor wanted him transferred to a hospital inside Israel, but his departure was delayed because the Israeli military, refused to grant his ambulance safe passage for more than an hour. He survived, but lost most of his teeth and his left eye was permanently damaged. He has had 3 facial reconstructive surgeries and is in need of 2 more. He is currently in the Bay Area on a speaking tour and spoke in Santa Cruz at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on Sunday, March 14th. Tonight on Rockin' the Boat, we'll hear his talk. Brian Avery of the International Solidarity Movement.
The ISM, it's a Palestinian-led group that basically works to confront the occupation in a very direct way. We go to the areas where the military are, basically, and assert ourselves there to be a documentary presence, and if at all possible, to palliate some of the aggression by the Israelis against the Palestinians. A lot of this occurs at some of the numerous checkpoints interspersed around the West Bank and within the West Bank, in which cases you have a lot of people detained for very long periods of time, hours and hours on end during their day, sometimes for the entire day. And this involves a lot of harassment, verbal abuse, physical abuse, and there have been instances of executions taking place at these checkpoints, just totally extrajudiciary executions. The effect upon the West Bank and Gaza Strip nowadays is literally akin to a maximum security prison. Basically, the entire area is closed in. You have to have permission to go in or out of the West Bank, Israeli permission to go in or out of the West Bank, and you have to have Israeli permission to travel within the West Bank as well. Around all the major cities, Jenin is up right in the northern area of the West Bank. You got Jenin, Nablus, the major areas, Jerusalem, Tukaram, Kalkilia, Hebron, Ramallah, all passage in and out of these towns and within the major areas and villages within the West Bank are controlled by the Israeli military. You have basically daily detainments at these checkpoints. You have detainments of people of all ages, all conditions, kids, sick people, pregnant people, women. And you have detainments of medical personnel and ambulances as well. And there have been numerous, quite a few documented cases of fatalities of people who were prevented travel to the hospital because they viewed their ambulance as some kind of security threat, which unfortunately a lot of allegations have flown around. The Israelis saying ambulances are used to harbor terrorists, to bury bombs, this and that. None of that has ever been substantiated. And so we would go to particularly Nablus because it's such a big area and there's so many checkpoints around. This was probably the biggest focus of our work there, is just to be able to document what was going on there, if it possible to directly intervene and negotiate with the soldiers, to try to encourage them to cease the harassment and punishment of the people, the collective punishment. Because basically what happens is you have a checkpoint. All Palestinians have an ID, an Israeli-issued ID. They're not citizens of Israel. They're not really citizens of anywhere. But they have this ID, and they have to present this ID at any checkpoint, or really at anywhere the Israeli demands, they have to present this ID. And a lot of these checkpoints, some of them are very formal, established. They're there every day. They've got like barricades and barriers and little guard houses and what we think of as a checkpoint. By and large, a lot of these are just simply they roll up in a tank in the middle of the road and say, you cannot pass. Literally the troll under the bridge. And so people go there, they have to show these IDs, present their credentials. If they do not have an ID, they are liable to be arrested on the spot, detained for an indefinite period of time. And the prisons are notorious. The Israeli jails and prisons are notorious for abuse and even torture, with, again, extrajudicial executions taking place. And so typically these people show these ID. What happens is they show the ID. There's a number on the ID that they corroborate, like a passport number. They call back to the office, see if this guy's number is on a list of suspected terrorists, militants, whatever. He's not on the list. He should be allowed to just go on by. This is not the case. These people take their IDs and they make them sit there for hours and hours on end. Typically, what you have is a collective punishment practice, basically, where they make all the people who ever come to this passageway that they feel necessary, they make them, which is basically the men, basically, sit there all day, and then at the end of the night, when it becomes dark, they send them on their way because. Once it becomes dark, there's basically a de facto curfew in effect in all areas, in which if you're out, if you're Palestinian out in these areas at night, you're very liable to be shot and killed as a suspect. And so this is what they do. They hold these people all day and then send them home at the end of the day when they can't go to work, they can't go to school, they can't go to their jobs, they can't go to visit their families. And a lot of times if they're coming from, say, a small village into Nablus, they'll hold them at the checkpoint all day, and at the end of the day say, no, go back where you came from. This is routine every day. We saw this every day go on. And I mean, people get, they shout at them, they shoot at them, they, you know, butt them with the rifles, shove them around. It doesn't matter what kind of weather it is, what's going on. They don't allow these people water. They don't allow food. They just make them sit there. When I was there, it was winter time. It wasn't so bad. But when you get the summertime and it's like 100-some-odd degrees heat and people have no water, you have people who have heat stroke and you have casualties there. So this is, it's, for us in Nablus, this is what we're trying to do. And it's kind of representative of what we're trying to do all over. We also did a lot of work with the emergency medical crews because you have a lot of occasions of, typically during a curfew is a 24-hour lockdown of the entire area. This means no one goes in and out of their house at all, and it can last for weeks or months at a time, and it has. And so the only Palestinians that have a chance of getting to move around are the medical crews, the ambulances, things like this. Unfortunately, a lot of times these are harassed quite a bit. The ambulances, even during the curfews, the checkpoints are there. You have to go through multiple checkpoints. Ambulances are shot at. They've been blown up with rockets, like fired from helicopters and airplanes. I mean, they are not spared any abuse by the military. And so typically what we go do is try to go with them and try to assist them in whatever they might need to do, because you have a lot of casualties in this situation. Because, for example, when the Israelis go in to do an incursion or an operation to arrest somebody, to search for weapons, whatever, and a lot of times they don't even go in to do that. They just go in to, you know, kind of shoot the place up and say who's boss. You get people who happen to get caught out in the street, people who get shot inside their houses because they're shooting at the buildings and with high caliber machinery. machine gun fire that do go through the walls, that do go through the doors and windows. When you go into these towns, there's not a building there that doesn't have multiple bullet holes in these buildings. Some of them are just completely pockmarked. So you have a lot of medical emergencies. And so we would try to go there, and again, to be there if we could, if these people got harassment, to try to mitigate that a little bit, try to make sure people could have an even slightly better chance of getting to the hospital, getting to whatever, and as well to document any of this harassment that might be going on. And so those are kind of our two staples, if you will. But we also did a lot of just kind of general work with the community. The ISM is a very loosely organized group. People there have a lot of autonomy. There's no contract. People there are not getting paid. They're there purely on their own terms, purely out of their own volition. It's all ages from like 18 to, you know, 80 years old, literally, all walks of life. And like I said, people go there anywhere from 2 weeks to, 6 months, 10 months, whatever. And it's there purely on their own volition. And it's basically there to organize and be a presence for people who do want to go there to see the situation, see what's going on, and to provide a bridge between them and the community that's there. So that when people go there, they're not just stepping on people's toes and totally offending everybody because they don't know any of the cultural attitudes or whatever of the culture there. So we train people, you know, we try to make sure to screen people as much as possible to, you know, make sure that people aren't coming in totally naive. This is a big, big thing that's been put in the media that a lot of these ISM people are just like naive college kids or whatever that have no idea what's going on. This is totally false. Most people who go there know exactly what's going on. They're there for a very specific reason because they know it's so bad. They're there to document what is going on. As part of this focus, you have a lot of autonomy into what you do there. You don't have to go to the ISM action, whatever, for the day. You can do, which a lot of people do. We spend a lot of time, for me, example, you know, you just walk around at the community meeting people. And it's people there are immensely hospitable. Just very welcoming to anybody who's obviously shown the willingness to look past, you know, what people dictate to them about what's going on and to take a real human interest into what's going on over there. And they've all got stories to tell, all got, you know, really, you know, nasty experiences to relate. And so this is, you know, a big part of the work is just to go there and to get these people's stories, things that are never published anywhere, never publicized or given media attention anywhere, other than certain elements of the Arabic press, which gets no airtime here in the States. And to, you know, to be a mechanism of transmission for what is going on in these people's lives and what their feelings are, and to try to erase this really horrible paradigm of them just being completely faceless and non-existent to the minds of most people in this country, because they do get pretty much zero representation in the newspapers and television media, apart from the militants who carry out attacks on the Israeli population. So this is our picture. This is all we get, you know. And it's about, you know, 0.5% of this, you know, not even that, of this entire population.
You're tuned into Free Radio Santa Cruz, 96.3 FM, 101 FM, or freakradio.org. This is Rockin' the Boat. You're tuned to Brian Avery. He gave a talk in Santa Cruz at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on Sunday, March 14th. Brian Avery was working with the International Solidarity Movement the first few months of 2003. On April 5th, 2003, he was shot in the face by an Israeli military tank. He lost most of the left side of his face and has had to have 3 facial reconstruction surgeries and is seeking 2 more. We're listening to him recount some of his experiences in the West Bank and in the occupied territories in Nablus. We're going to continue now with the rest of Brian Avery's talk. here on Rockin' the Boat.
When you have a situation that's basically like a prison and you have so much closure upon the area, you have a lot of idle energy, a lot of pent-up idle energy, particularly amongst the youth, the kids. Frequently, these kids can't go to school, and when they, even when they do go to school, maybe they go to school for a half a day, they come home, they got a lot of energy, they're out in the streets playing around, and sure enough, these really, you know, Humvee, a Jeep, tank rolls up, and you're inevitably going to have a clash, you know. These kids see these people in their towns, in their villages every day, shooting the place up, you know, killing their mothers, their brothers, their fathers, arresting their family members for, they never know if they'll see these people ever again. So there's a lot of resentment, a lot of anger. And so it's pretty natural for a kid to, you know, say, go away, speak his mind, you know, pick up a rock and throw it at the tank. That's kind of an image that's coming out. You know, these kids are very resistant, as they naturally should be. And unfortunately, when they get uppity like this, they get returned heavy caliber machine gun fire. And kids are getting killed all over the place because of this, you know. And it's like, when I say kids, it's like, it can be anywhere from like 5 years old to like, you know, like 18, 19. But there's a lot of young people being hurt and killed simply because they're there, because they happen to be in the crossfire. The military is very capricious in how it operates in the West Bank. Obviously, anything it does is never announced to the local population. If they announce a curfew, it's literally they just roll in with a couple of tanks and a bullhorn and say, stay inside your house until we tell you to come out. You know, with a good amount of machine gun fire into the area to kind of emphasize the point. They do this pretty frequently, even when it's not a curfew. Like I said, at nighttime, when it's a de facto curfew, it's pretty common that they just roll into the towns, the refugee camps, the villages, whatever, and just, you know, starting a loading machine gun fire, throwing out concussion bombs, which are like sound grenades. It's basically like a big, you know, firecracker. It just makes a lot of noise. And basically just to kind of disturb people, let them know, hey, here we are, we're hanging out, we're doing whatever we want to do, if you don't like it, too bad. And unfortunately, people do get killed this way because they happen to be stepping out of their house, they happen to be caught in the street, whatever. You know, sometimes we saw people who would be detained at these checkpoints all day until it was dark, and then the Israelis would say, okay, here, go home. You know, basically knowing full well that they're possibly condemning these people to death because they're sending them out in the streets in the dark. And unfortunately, this is because the Israeli military technique of indoctrinating their soldiers is to train them to be a very proactive force. That means individual action, individual decision making. It's not, okay, wait for the command. It's not, you know, do it, you know, explicitly do what you're told, you know, very, you know, defensive kind of group thing like our military is. No, it's a very individualistic, you're at your own discretion, basically. And so you got these guys that are just out there, and they're just, you know, they don't know how to deal with this situation, and they're dealing with it in a very reactionary and violent way. And so, coupled with this, you have, like I said, the closure. The closure is basically done under the aegis of security. Unfortunately, this is not really the case. It's really under the aegis of control of the area. Like I said, the, you know, passage in and out of this area and within this area is under total control. It's, you know, like any good maximum security prison. And what you have is, I saw this guy, Jeff Halper, he's a guy with the Israeli Committee Against House Demolition. He made the really beautiful analogy that in a prison, if you look at the schematic of a prison, it looks like all the areas are under control by the prisoners. You have, you know, the yards, the rooms, the access areas, the cafeterias. These are places for the prisoners. It looks like they have all the territory to themselves. And the guards have house here, guard tower here, very little. But they have maximum absolute control because they have high-powered weaponry. They have access points in and out, and the prisoners do not. And this is the situation that is going on. Mostly this by and large came into effect in about the last 10, 11 years after the Oslo Accords. Before that, there was a fair amount of travel in and out of Israel. A lot of people worked in Israel. And before this, you didn't have the suicide attacks, the terrorist bombings, things like this. Because there was pre-trial, there was relative fluidity in the society. And there was, you know, a lot of, you know, resistance to the occupation, but it was a very non-violent resistance. You know, people doing, organizing strikes, sit-ins, you know, basic civil disobedience type things, as well as just kind of going about their life. After the Oslo process and the apparent transfer of authority to an establishment of the Palestinian Authority, this whole area was closed off. And in effect, the actual authority given to the Palestinians was very, very little, only in the very urban areas, like the cities themselves, which are, you know, basically dots in this little territory. Everything else was still under complete control by the Israelis. And when they did this, they basically sealed the place off from Israel. People couldn't go to work anymore. They couldn't get assistance anymore. And so basically, they were totally at the mercy of the Israelis for all their economic things. All their goods bought, sold, traded in, all that had to come through Israel. And so basically we had a literal economic lockdown on the place and basically a mechanism for arbitrary sanctions to what they would let in and out. And so as this persisted and got worse, you started seeing the extremist attacks, the suicide attacks, which were pretty much basically all coordinated by the militant extremist groups, the religious groups. Before the Oslo process, the religious groups had a very minimal presence in the territories. All the coordination was done, it was very community-based, very secular-based. You had very mainstream political parties, basically who were aligned along political factions, who organized everything. They organized schools, clinics, all the stuff. It was, you know, really a really beautiful exercise in direct democracy, community democracy. The establishment of the PA basically smashed all of this. It basically said, okay, if you don't have a license from us, you can't do anything. And we'll, you know, enforce it with a gun. And if we can't enforce it, we'll get the Israelis to do it for us. Massive corruption in the PA. So basically you had this total closure and beginning of this totally oppressive situation within that, you know, basically just got worse and worse over the years. In the last 3.5 years since the Al-Aqsa Intifada, it has just gotten taken a nosedive for the worse. This is when it's really taken the high period of violence and the high penitentiary effect. Because you have not only closure within the society, you also have an increasement in the amount of settlement activity and Israeli confiscation of resources. The settlements have been basically going on since 1967, since the territory was occupied. And it's basically a de facto mechanism of the Israeli government to establish control of the territory there. They don't have to own all the land technically to control it. By inserting settlements in particular areas, funding these settlements, encouraging these settlements, these settlements basically become little knob points for their security control. When you have a settlement, you have to have a security parameter around the settlement. You have to have access roads between the settlements and Israel that are only accessible to the Israeli settlers. And when you build these roads, you have to have a security permit around these roads. And basically, these are just chopping right through villages and agricultural fields, cutting people off from their ability. The West Bank is a very rural agricultural society. These people literally live off the land. You know, olives, things like this, these are these people's livelihoods. And so when you go in and you just, you know, obliterate a swath through an olive orchard and say, you can't go to this side, these people are cut off. They have no way to live. You know, the unemployment rate in the West Bank is like 80%, 85% for most of the people most of the time. On some days when I was seeing it, it was probably more like 90, 95% because of some of the curfew and closure effects. So these people, they don't have work, they don't have money. They are getting by the bare minimum of food and medicine and medical supplies. Poverty and malnutrition rates, health-related disease rates, they're just flying up. And so basically, you have increasing amounts of these settlements, and a lot of these settlements are placed in key areas that gives the Israelis complete control over the water resources in particular. The water is a big issue there. Because you have such a small area, you don't have a lot of water there. They have some certain underground water aquifers. And basically, the Israelis at this point have near total control over all these aquifers. A lot of it is pumped out into Israel itself. A good portion is for the settlements themselves. And what little remains, they actually sell back to the Palestinians. These people have no control over any of their resources. And so when you have these settlements, they tend to be a lot of the immigrant populations coming into Israel, a lot of the poor sections that they get put out there. So you have very reactionary, extremist type people going out there, and these people will go out and harass these settlers and harass the people in the villages in the West Bank around, because they can go out, they get guns and weapons fully under the support of the Israeli government. They go out down into people's fields, into people's orchards, and just start, shooting around and basically say, no, we control this area. You can't come in here. And some people can't go harvest their crops. They can't go to the next village, whatever have you may. And if they get into a situation, a confrontation with the local villagers, the army swoops in and completely takes the sides of the settlers. And a lot of times you have it where they go in, there's a confrontation, a security risk is determined, and they basically confiscate more land to create a bigger security perimeter. And so it's just like, it's like a drop in the water. You put the settlement in, it just ripples out, and the effect that it has upon the society, and the amount of the land that they take control of, that they seed up. The wall that's going around is basically a mechanism to further compound this. It does not go on the border of the West Bank. It goes way inside the border. Basically, if this is all the West Bank, this is like, this blue line is like the wall. They're basically just chopping all of that off, chopping all of this off, and just, just slowly shrinking away what territory people have access to. And I assure you, as you have these walls, these security barriers, you will have determinations by Israel of security threats that they have to take even more of the territory. It's an endless ongoing process, basically, to continue the de facto control and annexation of the land. Basically, the end effect will be to literally just concentrate these people into these small areas, and basically literally imprison them in these very clustered areas, to which the rest of the territory they have no access to.
You just heard a talk by Brian Avery. He spoke in Santa Cruz at the Resource Center for Nonviolence on Sunday, March 14th, 2004. In April 2003, Brian Avery was shot in the face by an Israeli soldier while wearing a bright red jacket and trying to protect a child caught in the crossfire. When he raised himself from the ground, witnesses saw that his left cheek had almost been totally shot off. The bullet entered the upper right side of his nose and blew out the bones of the left side of his nose, cheek, and upper jaw. For more information about the International Solidarity Movement, of which Brian Avery is a part, check out their website, www.palsolidarity.org. That's PALSolidarity.org. That's it for Rockin' the Boat tonight. My name is the V-Man. Join me again each weekday, Monday through Friday, from 5:30 to 6 p.m. right here at 96.3 FM, 101.1 FM, www.freakradio.org. Stay tuned, and thanks for listening.